Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be presenting the second of our two-part episode about the 1987 deaths of Don Henry and Kevin Ives, aka the Boys on the Track case. As you probably know, The Trail Went Cold has finally reached a very special milestone and is celebrating its five-year anniversary as a podcast, so to commemorate the occasion, we decided to cover one of our most highly requested cases ever. But the story is so convoluted that for only the second time in our podcast's history, we decided to make it a two-parter. We released part one last week, which outlined the most important facts of the case, and if you haven't heard it yet, I suggest you go back and listen to our first episode, because otherwise, you'll be completely lost when you listen to this one. Today, I'm going to be fleshing out and going into more detail about most of the information I presented last week, as well as provide my own theories and analysis. As a brief recap, the two victims in this story were 16-year-old Don Henry and 17-year-old Kevin Ives, who were both seen lying in the middle of some railroad tracks in Saline County, Arkansas, before they were run over by a cargo train during the early morning hours of August the 23rd, 1987. While their deaths were initially ruled to be accidental, there was a lot of new evidence which clearly showed that both boys were the victims of foul play, and the case would balloon into a massive story with a number of conspiracy theories and allegations that Kevin and Don were murdered as part of a massive cover-up from people who were involved in drug trafficking. It's an awful lot to take in, so we're going to try and make some sense of this entire thing on today's episode. So let's get right down to it. Without any further ado, I now present part two of the convoluted saga known as The Boys on the Track. So if last week's episode was your introduction to The Boys on the Tracks case, and you felt like your brain was on the verge of exploding, I can assure you, it wasn't always this way. When I sat down to start summarizing this story, I really had no idea where to begin, but I guess the best course of action would be to discuss the original Unsolved Mystery segment. I vividly remember watching it on TV when it first aired, 1 week before my 10th birthday, and it goes without saying that it seriously creeped me out. From a production standpoint, this is definitely one of the scariest segments Unsolved Mysteries ever produced, as most of the reenactments took place in dark, desolate locations, and the show's earliest seasons often had this realistic, grainy-looking documentary style which added to the unsettling atmosphere. Viewing this at such a young age, the idea of these two teenage boys stumbling across something inside those dark woods, which led to them being murdered and placed on the tracks to be run over by a train, was pretty terrifying. When the segment originally aired, the only mention of drugs was the marijuana that Don Henry and Kevin Ives supposedly had in their systems when they died, and it was not until Unsolved Mysteries aired a brief update a few weeks later that Richard Garrett made his first mention of drug trafficking, which would become the prevalent theory in this case for the next 3 decades. Of course, the show never made any mention of Bill Clinton, and truthfully, as a young Canadian citizen who didn't exactly have extensive knowledge about state governors, I wouldn't have even known who he was at that time. I certainly never would have envisioned him being elected President of the United States within the next 4 years and being linked to this case, so much so that there are people out there who believe he personally had a hand in these murders. Now, I'll state right up front that I do not want to get political on this episode, as I only intend to focus on the known facts, but if you do any research on this case, Bill Clinton's name will keep popping up, so I have to address the whole situation. I'm sure most of you have heard of the conspiracy known as the Clinton body count, which alleges that Bill and Hillary Clinton have been responsible for the murders of upwards of 50 people. And if you decide to look up any of the so-called body count lists that have circulated online these past 25 years, Don Henry and Kevin Ives' names are on them, as well as a number of other murder victims connected to this case. As a result, the story has kind of become larger than life, and researching it is quite a challenge. On our last episode, I previously talked about how Clinton was linked to this case through his relationship with the Arkansas State Medical Examiner, Dr. Fahmy Malik, which I'll talk more about momentarily. But it's also been alleged that Don and Kevin's deaths were somehow connected to the Mina scandal, which took place in the small town of Mina, Arkansas during the 1980s. A prominent conspiracy theory is that the CIA reportedly used Mina Intermountain Municipal Airport to smuggle weapons and ammunition to the Contras in Nicaragua and drugs back into the United States, and this was done with the full complicity and knowledge of several powerful individuals. This whole story is way too complicated to delve into here, which is why I'm only going to talk about it briefly, but since he was governor of Arkansas during that time period, it's been alleged that Clinton was involved, or at the very least, knew what was going on. The key figure who ran this whole operation in Mina was a pilot named Barry Seal, who used his aircraft to transport guns and drugs and smuggle cocaine for the Medellin cartel in Colombia. Seal has attained a bit more notoriety in recent years because he was portrayed by Tom Cruise in the 2017 film American Made, which was based on the Mina scandal, though you probably shouldn't look at it as a source of historical accuracy. When Seal ran into serious legal troubles, he became an informant for the Drug Enforcement Administration before he was assassinated by contract killers from the Medellin cartel in February of 1986. Even though his death took place a full year and a half before Don Henry and Kevin Ives were killed, you'll often see Barry Seal's name mentioned in conjunction with this case. But I don't want to get too sidetracked, as you would need an entirely separate long-form podcast to really delve into the full details about Seal and the Mina scandal. If you want to learn more about them, check out journalist Mara Leverett's book about this case, The Boys on the Tracks, Death, Denial, and a Mother's Crusade to Bring Her Son's Killers to Justice, which devotes a few chapters to this crazy side story. Now, Mina is located over 100 miles away from Saline County, but I can see why these two stories are often linked, as the most prevalent theory is that drug drops were being done by airplanes over the train tracks where Kevin and Don were killed, and the two boys wound up crossing paths with the wrong people. Bill Clinton's alleged complicity in the Mina scandal is a subject which belongs on an entirely different podcast, but it is a confirmed fact that he was an ally of Dr. Fahmy Malik. And if Malik had not screwed things up so badly, I'm not sure if Clinton ever would have been associated with this case. It would be easy to infer that Malik decided to rule the boys' deaths as accidental in order to orchestrate a cover-up, but here's the thing. This was far from the only case he completely botched. A couple of years ago, True Crime Garage did a four-part series about the boys on the tracks, and one of the most memorable aspects was the captain's takedown of Fahmy Malik, as the episodes detailed so many of his epic screw-ups that the captain finally said, quote, "Well, that's just Fahmy being Fahmy." Well, this might be a bit of a broad statement, but I'm willing to believe that no one else in the history of human civilization has ever been more incompetent at their job than Fahmy Malik. His conclusions about Kevin and Don falling into a deep sleep after smoking 20 marijuana cigarettes is laughable enough, but believe it or not, that is not even close to the most mind-boggling conclusion he has made following an autopsy. I mentioned during part one of this episode that I was going to discuss some of the other investigations Malik botched, but here are some of the most memorable. In 1985, a man named Raymond Albright was shot to death with a large caliber pistol, and Malik ruled his death to be a suicide, even though he was shot in the chest 5 times. That same year, a man named Jimmy Segrist was found dead in a body of water, and his death was ruled to be an accidental drowning, which sounds reasonable, except that Malik had completely overlooked a bullet in the victim's skull. But the biggest whopper has to be the 1987 death of a man named James Dewey Milam, whose headless body was found inside his home. And what was Malik's official cause of death? Decapitation? No, of course not. That would be too logical. The cause of death was actually a perforated ulcer. You see, Malik concluded that after Milam died, his dog must have bitten off his head and eaten it. He even claimed that after the dog regurgitated, the police brought him the vomit for testing, where he found traces of Milam's brain matter. No, seriously. After hearing this story, I can now understand why the bereaved families of these victims decided to name their organization VOMIT, an acronym for Victims of Malik's Incredible Testimony. These are only a handful of many examples of obvious murders that were never solved because of Malik's incompetence. However, while information about many of the cases Malik botched is rather limited, I think it's safe to say that they were not all part of a mammoth conspiracy involving drug trafficking and Bill Clinton. You might recall my story from last week's episode about how Clinton's mother had worked as a nurse anesthetist, and Malik's ruling in the death of one of her patients may have faced her from facing serious liability, so this might explain why Clinton always protected Malik and prevented him from losing his job during his tenure as governor. But the issue is that Malik's conclusions in many of his cases were so bizarre that it's really hard to gauge if he was covering up for people, or if he just came to these conclusions because he lived on his own planet. It's possible that his decision to rule Don and Kevin's deaths as accidental may have been born out of corruption, or it may simply have been because he was utterly terrible at his job. Don't get me wrong, I still believe that something incredibly shady occurred in this case, but the idea that Bill Clinton personally ordered Fahmy Malik to shut down the investigation is pretty far-fetched. Now, the thing is, the biggest advocate for the two boys, Kevin's mother, Linda Ives, has always attempted to keep politics out of this case. The Clinton connection really took off after the story was featured in Patrick Matriciana's 1994 documentary, The Clinton Chronicles, which has been cited as one of the sources which helped perpetuate the Clinton body count conspiracy. But while Linda was grateful that the Clinton Chronicles gave her son's case additional exposure, and was happy how Matriciana handled that particular section, she did think that the rest of the claims in the documentary were rather sensationalistic. That's why Linda and Gene Duffy insisted on full editorial control when Matriciana produced his follow-up documentary about the case, Obstruction of Justice, The Mina Connection. But whenever Linda did interviews on radio talk shows to spread awareness about the story, she found it frustrating that they often just wanted to talk about Bill Clinton and the scandals he was allegedly involved in. Linda definitely had her own frustrations with Clinton, as she pretty much ignored his demands to remove Fahmy Malik during his tenure as governor, but she always made it very clear that she did not have a political agenda and was not interested in using the case as a platform to attack the president. All she cared about was finding justice for Kevin and Don. But to give you an idea of how out of control these conspiracy theories have gotten, I want to talk about the recent developments involving former professional wrestler Billy Jack Haynes. If you know me well at all, you'll know that I've been a pro wrestling fan since childhood, and at the time I started watching, Billy Jack Haynes was a performer for the World Wrestling Federation, aka the WWF, though it is now currently known as World Wrestling Entertainment, aka WWE. I previously joked that I wouldn't have known who Bill Clinton was back when I originally watched the Unsolved Mysteries segment about this case, but I certainly would have known who Billy Jack Haynes was, and yes, I even owned a rubber Billy Jack wrestling doll at that time. So if you told me back then that Billy Jack would end up being linked to the Boys on the Track case 30 years later, I would have said you were crazy. I still remember when the news broke back in 2018 that Billy Jack had come forward and confessed his involvement in the murder. I saw many people in the true crime community express their surprise and wonder if this was going to be a major break in the case. But I can tell you that the reaction in the pro wrestling community was a collective eye roll, and even though a number of mainstream media outlets in Arkansas ran with this story, I think they might have thought twice about it if they knew more about Billy Jack's background. Let's put it this way. Pro wrestling is a very unique and colorful industry filled with a lot of crazy characters who have done a number of crazy things, but even by their standards, Billy Jack Haynes is considered to be on a whole other level of crazy. The guy has definitely led a very difficult life and had serious issues with drugs and CTE, likely brought on by the numerous concussions and injuries he suffered throughout his pro wrestling career, but he also has a notorious reputation for spreading some truly outrageous conspiracy theories. As an example, many of you are probably familiar with the story of pro wrestler Chris Benoit, who murdered his wife Nancy and 7-year-old son Daniel inside their home in June of 2007 before he ended his own life. Well, according to Billy Jack, Benoit's motive for this crime was finding out that his boss, WWE chairman Vince McMahon, once had an affair with his wife and was actually the real biological father of his son, so this caused Benoit to snap and murder them. Well, I could point out a million things wrong with this insane theory, but all you really have to do to discredit the whole thing is look up a photo of Daniel Benoit, who is clearly a spitting image of his father. I should also mention that this was not the only Unsolved Mysteries case that Billy Jack has inserted himself into. At one point, he tried to claim he was involved in the murder of Michael Franke, which took place in Salem, Oregon, on January the 17th, 1989. Franke was the director of Oregon's Department of Corrections before he was stabbed to death in the parking lot of his place of employment, and even though a suspect named Frank Gable was eventually convicted of the murder, his conviction was overturned in 2019. So of course, this case is also rife with conspiracy theories. Well, Billy Jack has tried to claim that he was one of several individuals who was hired to attack Franke because he was a pedophile, but I can safely say that this is likely 100% false. While I do not believe Billy Jack's story for a second, I can kind of understand why he would insert himself into the Michael Franke case, as Billy Jack hails from Oregon, and he was actually running his own independent wrestling promotion there in 1989. But his decision to insert himself into the Boys on the Track case is pretty random, to say the least. Even before he did this, Billy Jack often claimed in interviews that he got himself involved in drug trafficking and other criminal activity after he left the wrestling business because he was desperate for money. But I somehow doubt this would have been occurring during the summer of 1987 when he was still a full-time employee with the World Wrestling Federation. There are websites out there which have listings for every WWF show, and they confirm that Billy Jack did wrestle at a show in Detroit on August the 21st of that year, and the next match he wrestled took place in San Francisco on August the 25th. So technically, yes, Billy Jack would have been available to travel down to Arkansas during the time period when Don Henry and Kevin Ives were killed. But if you worked for the WWF during the 1980s, you were out on the road traveling non-stop, and it was pretty much your entire life. Billy Jack wrestled on nearly 250 shows in 1987 alone, so I just don't see how he even would have found the time to get involved with a group of drug traffickers. And while I can understand the logic of drug traffickers hiring a large guy like him to function as their muscle at a drug drop, it really doesn't make much sense to hire a recognizable pro wrestler who was constantly appearing on national television during that time period. Billy Jack claimed that they were working under the orders of a quote-unquote criminal politician, and while the media declined to publish the politician's name, I would not be surprised at all if he was referring to Bill Clinton. Now, I mentioned in my previous episode that there's a website devoted to this case at idfiles.com, but judging from some posts which were made on that site in 2019, it appears that Linda Ives and Gene Duffy had a major falling out with Keith Rounceval, the private investigator who put them in contact with Billy Jack Haynes, and they no longer consider Billy Jack to be a credible source. Apparently, the GoFundMe account that Rounceval had set up for supporters to donate money to the investigation was a scam, and the YouTube video where Billy Jack shared his story has since been taken down. Overall, I think you can completely discount Billy Jack's version of events, but I still felt it was worth discussing in order to demonstrate the truly unexpected directions this case has gone in. So now I'm going to start downplaying the conspiracy aspects of this case and start focusing on the known facts and the two victims, as we try to figure out what actually happened to Kevin and Don. In addition to finding out the truth about what happened, another thing Linda has always fought for is her son's reputation, as throughout the years, there have been a lot of unsubstantiated rumors that the two boys were killed because they themselves were involved in drug dealing, or because they stole some drugs from dangerous people. In fact, there was one specific theory which involved them stealing cocaine, but we'll talk more about that in a little while. However, Linda has always believed that Kevin and Don were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time and were murdered because they saw something they weren't supposed to see. It's also worth mentioning that when Kevin was 14 years old, both he and a friend of his were caught with a joint in their possession by a police officer, and they wound up going to court and being placed on probation. The Ives family took the situation so seriously that Kevin's father, Larry, forced him to take random urine tests at the hospital lab for the next several months, and they always came back clean, so obviously, the situation put a big scare into Kevin. Now, it's been established that Kevin and Don were smoking marijuana on the night they were killed, though they obviously did not smoke 20 joints. The two boys had only been friends for 6 months at that point, and the Iveses really did not even know the Henry family, so perhaps Don had influenced Kevin into bending the law a bit, especially when you consider that they went into the woods that night to go spotlighting, which was also illegal. But smoking a few joints is still a far cry from them dealing or stealing drugs. While the Henry family also wanted justice for Don, they were nowhere near as outspoken as Linda Ives, and eventually moved away from Saline County, as Curtis apparently felt there might be repercussions against his daughter, Gayla, if he pushed things too far. But interestingly enough, at one point, Curtis did tell an investigator that following the boys' deaths, he often went walking around the train tracks in the middle of the night to try and figure out what might have happened. He began to notice that a small airplane was making weekly landings on a piece of property near the tracks, but when he turned this information over to the Arkansas State Police, nothing was done. But Curtis also had his suspicions that drug drops were being made in the area, and that Don and Kevin may have stumbled upon one. So let's go back to the night in question. Before they were run over by the train, we have a window of around 4 hours when the boys' whereabouts are completely unaccounted for, so anything could have happened to them during that time period. The first major controversy in this case was the disappearance of the green tarp, which was supposedly covering their bodies on the tracks before the train arrived, as all three members of the train's crew were certain they saw it, and were quite surprised when law enforcement attempted to deny its existence. One of the most vivid parts of the Unsolved Mystery segment is the interview with the engineer, Stephen Schroyer, who gets pretty emotional, and he is clearly still quite shaken and devastated about the situation, even though the boys' deaths were definitely not his fault. But one thing Schroyer was absolutely certain of was that the tarp was there, and the conductor, Jerry Tomlin, always maintained that he saw the tarp after the police arrived and pointed it out to a deputy. The optical illusion explanation that law enforcement provided made no sense, since three separate witnesses reported seeing the tarp, and what's particularly interesting is that Larry Ives was also an engineer who had experience driving locomotives on that exact route at night, so he also found that logic to be insulting. It seems pretty likely that someone intentionally made that tarp disappear, as neither of the boys owned such a tarp, so its presence there pretty much debunked the accidental death theory, and there was always a possibility that the tarp could be traced back to the person who covered the bodies. However, if you discount the whole episode with the tarp, it's still a major red flag that the Saline County Sheriff's Office seemed to have no intention of treating the scene as a potential homicide. In the days following the deaths, they interviewed a number of Don and Kevin's friends and classmates, and it sounds like most of their questions revolved around asking whether the boys were suicidal or involved in drugs, and they never even inquired about the possibility of foul play. Every good investigator will tell you that you should always treat every death as a potential homicide at the beginning, and only start leaning towards suicide or accidental death if that's where the evidence leads you. But here, in spite of the very unusual circumstances of how Kevin and Don were killed, it appears like the sheriff's office had already made up their minds that no crime had taken place, and you have to wonder if that was by design. Now, I mentioned in my previous episode that when the Obstruction of Justice documentary was released in 1996, they put up a graphic which listed 6 members of law enforcement whom they believed were involved in what happened. Dan Harmon, Richard Garrett, Jim Steed, Jay Campbell, Kirk Lane, and Danny Allen. Since these men worked with a number of different law enforcement agencies, this implies that there was a pretty far-reaching conspiracy, and I'll be discussing each of these men as we go along. Jim Steed was the first of them to arouse suspicion, since he was Saline County Sheriff at the time, and seemed so disinterested in investigating the two deaths as a possible homicide that he never even bothered showing up at the scene that night, which seems pretty odd when two of your residents have been run over by a train. Throughout the investigation, Steed was caught in a few lies, and not even the grand jury investigation caused him to waver from his belief that the boys' deaths were accidental. Whatever his complicity might have been, the controversy did a lot of damage to Steed's reputation, as he wound up losing his re-election bid for county sheriff, and I'm sure it didn't help that the election took place less than a month after the Unsolved Mysteries segment originally aired. During this time period, Steed was seen as the bad guy, while Dan Harmon and Richard Garrett were the White Knights, who were helping these two grieving families seek justice. And this leads me to what has always been my biggest issue with this conspiracy theory. The idea that Harmon and Garrett were involved in what happened to Kevin and Don. I can't believe it's taken me this long to make this joke, but no, in case you're wondering, this is not the same Dan Harmon who created the popular TV shows Community and Rick and Morty, though I think someone could probably create an interesting TV series based on this guy's life. There is zero doubt that Harmon was definitely a bad guy who used his power as Saline County prosecuting attorney to do a number of corrupt and illegal things, and he was also an habitual drug user who abused most of the women in his life. It's been alleged that Harmon was the mastermind behind the murders and present at the tracks when Don and Kevin were killed, but this begs the question, if he was involved, why would he have played a role in reopening the investigation in the first place? To backtrack, after the Ives and Henry families held a press conference in which they publicly expressed their dissatisfaction with the investigation, Richard Garrett phoned Linda the very next day to express his interest in re-examining the case. Garrett has also been accused of being involved in the cover-up, and there have always been rumors about his corruption, but unlike Harmon, he was never charged with any crimes. Now that the case was starting to generate publicity, I guess you could assume that Garrett was doing damage control and preventing the investigation from falling into the hands of outside agencies, but it's not like he did a half-assed job, as he held a public prosecutor's hearing and pushed for the grand jury investigation. Garrett also took the initiative of having Kevin and Don's bodies exhumed and hiring a competent forensic pathologist, Dr. Joseph Burton, to perform new autopsies. Before this, their deaths were officially ruled to be accidental, but Burton's findings uncovered evidence which allowed them to be reclassified as homicides. Again, why would Garrett do all this if he was complicit? Well, the explanation which has often been provided is that Garrett and Harmon wanted to use their power to create misdirection in the investigation and ensure that the perpetrators would never be implicated. In Harmon's case, he also wanted to manipulate the media and ensure that he would be painted as a heroic crusader for justice, and it's been reported that during a visit to the residence of 7th Judicial District Court Judge John Cole, he personally requested to be appointed special prosecutor in order to lead the investigation. Indeed, I think this positive publicity did play a role in helping Harmon get elected Saline County prosecuting attorney. Since Garrett was the one who first took the initiative to contact Linda Ives, a potential alternate explanation is that Garrett was completely innocent, but since Harmon was his law partner at the time, he took the opportunity to insert himself into the investigation and ensure it wouldn't lead to him. Harmon was definitely the one who took the reins during the grand jury proceedings, though Garrett did investigative work behind the scenes and seemed to become the case's official spokesperson since he was interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries. Now, I mentioned in my last episode that the website, idfiles.com, has a number of documents posted from the FBI investigation during the mid-1990s, though many of them are so heavily redacted that they're practically useless. But one of the most intriguing tidbits from these documents is that Garrett was in charge of handling all the phone tips that came into the Unsolved Mysteries telecenter after the episode aired, and while many of them were anonymous, some of the tipsters who did leave their names apparently soon found themselves receiving threats to stay silent. And in one report, the FBI actually recommended that the Unsolved Mysteries segment be remade because a number of new developments had taken place since it originally aired, and the segment featured individuals who were suspected of being involved in the cover-up. Obviously, this never came to fruition, since the segment which you can currently watch on Amazon Prime and YouTube is the same one that originally aired back in 1988, but given how prominently Garrett is featured, I can see how it might be interpreted that the FBI was referring to him. Interestingly enough, the segment also mentioned that Garrett had uncovered another similar case from Oklahoma, which involved two young men and a train. It turned out that the case in question took place on June the 25th, 1984, in a remote area of LaFleur County, which is about 150 miles west of Saline County. The two victims were 26-year-old Billy Hainline and 21-year-old Dennis Decker, who both hailed from the town of Heavener and were killed after being run over by a freight train on a stretch of the Kansas City Southern Railroad. Like Don and Kevin, Billy and Dennis had been lying parallel to each other on the tracks in identical positions before the train hit them, and since autopsies allegedly found alcohol in their systems, the county coroner ruled that they had gotten drunk and fallen asleep on the tracks, so their deaths were accidental. Much like this case, the victims' families had a hard time believing that and pushed to have the investigation reopened. When the state medical examiner's office performed new autopsies, they discovered that only one of the victims had alcohol in their system, and it was a very slight amount. As a result, their cause of death was officially changed to unknown, and the investigation was reopened, but it doesn't sound like it went anywhere. Believe it or not, there was actually another similar case which took place on the Kansas City Southern Railroad, this time in Newton County, Michigan, during the early morning hours of August the 20th, 1985. These two victims were 15-year-old Sean Reinecke and 13-year-old David Taylor, who were both killed outside their hometown of Newton when they were struck by a freight train on an overpass. Now, I see no indication that these deaths were anything more than a tragic accident, as it seemed like Sean and David were attempting to position themselves between the tracks before the train passed over them, but they miscalculated and were killed. But the case from Oklahoma is a lot more complicated, as about a month after Billy and Dennis were killed, a clandestine methamphetamine laboratory was discovered about a mile and a half away from the spot on the tracks where they were found. While it's certainly possible they were murdered because they happened to stumble upon this lab, there was no conclusive evidence to prove this. But I find it interesting how when Richard Garrett was brought back to be interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries for an update segment, he brought up the possibility of drug trafficking. I believe this was the first time anyone ever publicly mentioned this possibility, but of course, it became the most prevalent theory in this case for the next 3 decades. Now, once again, if Garrett was involved, why would he bring up the whole drug trafficking angle on national television? Well, he did specifically mention the possibility of Kevin and Don being killed because they stumbled upon a lab which manufactured methamphetamine, but the woods near the railroad tracks were searched several times, and no evidence was ever found to suggest any meth labs ever existed there. So if Garrett was complicit, could he have been using his knowledge about the Oklahoma case to create misdirection in the investigation and divert attention away from the drug drops which were being conducted with airplanes? Well, in May of 1990, only a few months after Dan Harmon was elected Saline County prosecuting attorney, he uncovered another potential lead involving a woman named Catherine Brightop, as Harmon was prosecuting her ex-boyfriend, Paul William Criswell, on charges of distributing cocaine. According to Brightop, Criswell had once told her that Don and Kevin were murdered because they had been caught stealing cocaine from the home of a used car dealer named James Calloway, prompting Calloway and 3 other men to chase the boys down and kill them before placing their bodies on the track. While Calloway did have a connection to the boys, as Don was longtime friends with his daughter, and she was the one who introduced Don to Kevin to begin with. And Calloway acknowledged that both Don and Kevin had visited his home on numerous occasions. Calloway was also involved in drug dealing and other criminal activity, and it was also believed that Keith Coney had been selling drugs on his behalf. But the problem is that Calloway had lost his house in a divorce settlement and moved out of the area prior to August the 23rd, 1987. And in an odd twist of fate, Richard Garrett had been Calloway's lawyer during his divorce proceedings. So the story about the two boys stealing cocaine from Calloway's residence did not hold up, and nothing ever linked them to the crime. Of course, the Ives and Henry families refused to believe that Don and Kevin would have ever ripped off cocaine from anyone, so if Harmon was actually complicit, you have to wonder if this was his attempt to create misdirection and lead the investigation down the wrong path. I mentioned in my previous episode that Harmon soon found himself butting heads with Gene Duffy, a deputy prosecutor who had been assigned to Saline County to coordinate a drug task force and probe allegations of corruption among local officials. I'm not going to delve too deeply into this because it will distract from the main story, but if you want more information about all the drama between Harmon and Duffy, check out the Mara Leverett book, Boys on the Track. But long story short, once Harmon found out that Duffy was going to be investigating his illegal activities, he attempted to threaten and discredit her at every turn. She would eventually be fired over allegations of financial mismanagement, child abuse, and official improprieties, and was forced to leave the state, though she was eventually cleared of all charges. As a result, Duffy became one of Linda Ives' biggest allies, and she also had a lot of editorial control over the Obstruction of Justice documentary. Even though Harmon ultimately wound up being charged with several felonies and serving time in prison, it sounds like this should have happened many years earlier than it did. The original grand jury investigation into the Ives-Henry case dragged on for several months longer than anyone expected, and while no one was ever indicted for the murders, Harmon did use this as an opportunity to indict some of the witnesses he had subpoenaed on unrelated charges involving drugs and robbery. He also subpoenaed a number of police officers to testify, many of whom did not seem to have any apparent connection to this case. But it's been theorized that Harmon was trying to gauge how much law enforcement might have known about his own illegal activities. In other words, Harmon used the grand jury investigation for his own political gain, but never had any intention of finding justice for Don and Kevin. Okay, I mentioned in my previous episode that a number of odd deaths took place in this section of Arkansas during this time period, many of which are suspected of being connected to this case. I already went over the deaths of Keith Coney and Keith McCaskill, and I'll delve more into them momentarily, but here are some of the other ones. Like Keith Coney, a number of these victims have been subpoenaed to testify at the grand jury proceedings, but failed to appear. On January 22, 1989, 26-year-old Greg Collins, who originally hailed from Saline County, was found dead in a forest in Nevada County after receiving 3 shotgun blasts to the face at close range. Collins was a friend of Keith Coney, and there were rumors that he had been seen with Don and Kevin on the night they were killed, though this was never substantiated, and Collins' murder was never solved. In March of that year, police received an anonymous phone tip about a 19-year-old man from Saline County named Daniel Bearden, who went by the nickname Booney and had been missing for the past 8 months. The caller directed them to a remote area near the town of Redfield, where Bearden was supposedly murdered and buried, but while they never found his body, one of his t-shirts was discovered in the Arkansas River. Bearden was known to be friends with Keith Coney and Greg Collins, and rumored to be involved in drugs and burglaries. In May of 1988, Bearden had informed the Arkansas State Police that Coney had told him that police officers were involved in the deaths of Don Henry and Kevin Ives. 2 days after Bearden made this report, Coney was killed in his bizarre motorcycle accident, and Bearden has still not been found to this day. In April of 1989, 21-year-old Jeff Rhodes, another Saline County resident who was believed to be involved in the drug trade, was found dead in a landfill. He had been shot twice in the head before his body was cut up and set on fire. 2 months earlier, Rhodes had reportedly contacted his father in Texas and told him he was looking to move out of the area because he knew too much about the murder of Keith McCaskill. Unlike many of these other murders, this one was actually solved when a suspect named Frank Pilcher was charged with the crime and received a life sentence, though speculation still abounds that at the very least, Rhodes knew something about McCaskill's death. It's also worth mentioning that Rhodes was believed to have worked for a Saline County cocaine dealer named Ron Kettleson, whose 21-year-old son Jordan Kettleson died under suspicious circumstances in June of 1990 when he was found dead in his truck with a shotgun blast to the head. Jordan Kettleson's death was ruled to be a suicide, and his body was subsequently cremated without an autopsy being performed, but he was a convicted drug dealer, and it's been reported that Frank Pilcher had named Kettleson as being responsible for Keith McCaskill's murder. There's one more death you'll often see grouped in with the others, and it involves another Saline County man named Richard Winters, who was fatally shot in self-defense during the attempted robbery of a gambling house in Lenoke County in July of 1989. It was alleged that James Calloway had recruited Winters to perform the robbery and set him up to be killed because Winters was one of the men who helped Calloway kill Kevin and Don after they were caught stealing cocaine from him. However, if you believe the cocaine story is false and Calloway had nothing to do with the boys' murders, then Winters' death has no significance to this case at all. Conspiracy theorists will have you believe that all these deaths are linked to each other and part of the massive cover-up which arose from the Boys on the Tracks murders, but let's not forget that all these people seem to be involved in drugs, robbery, and other forms of criminal activity, so it's not a stretch to believe that they may have been killed for other reasons. As you might have noticed, the only real connection many of these people have to Kevin Ives and Don Henry is through Keith Coney and Keith McCaskill, and I guess it would depend on if those two deaths were directly connected to the Boys on the Track. If you go on YouTube, you'll find an amateur documentary titled Murder on the Tracks, The Story of Kevin Ives and Don Henry, which was put together by a man named Ron Dane and attempts to piece together this massive jigsaw puzzle. So here's the theory it presents about what happened to Kevin and Don on the night they were killed. When the two boys went out hunting in the woods, they made it to the railroad tracks, where Dan Harmon and some accomplices were waiting for a drug drop to take place by airplane. We have the young eyewitness, Tom Niehaus, who claims that he was hiding in the woods with his friends and witnessed Harmon and his accomplices spot Kevin and Don and approach them. But then all of a sudden, a shot was fired, possibly from Don's hunting rifle, and the two boys took off into the woods. Now, according to the mysterious eyewitness known only as Jerry, he later saw Kevin and Don with a third young man in the parking lot of the Ranchette grocery store, which is not that far away from the tracks. It's been theorized that this third man was Keith Coney, who gave Kevin and Don a ride to the parking lot on his motorcycle while they were fleeing the woods. It's possible that they were planning to use the payphone in order to inform someone about what they had seen at the tracks, but then an unmarked police car showed up, and Coney took off on his motorcycle. The two police officers in question were alleged to be Jay Campbell and Kirk Lane, who subsequently beat up Kevin and Don, stuffed them inside their car, and drove them back to the tracks. In addition to Jerry, a second eyewitness named Ronnie Godwin was near the store that night and claimed to have seen this. Now, as for Keith McCaskill, it's possible he became involved when Keith Coney rode his motorcycle to McCaskill's club, the Wagon Wheel Lounge, to inform him about what was going on. McCaskill then made it to the tracks on time to witness Kevin and Don have their bodies laid out before they were run over by the train. And over the course of the next year, Coney and McCaskill, and possibly the other individuals I mentioned, such as Greg Collins and Booney Bearden, were eliminated because they knew too much. The story provided by Tom Niehaus is that he saw five men at the tracks approaching Kevin and Don, and they are believed to be Harmon, Campbell, and Lane, as well as Danny Allen, another police officer whom I'll discuss later on, and another man named Larry Rochelle, though there's virtually no information available about this guy, so I'm not entirely sure who he is. We have a second eyewitness who confessed to being at the tracks and witnessing the murders that night, Harmon's ex-girlfriend, Charlene Wilson. As far as I can tell, she never implicated Campbell and Lane, so it's possible they left the scene after dropping off Kevin and Don, but Wilson did implicate Keith McCaskill. So we have four eyewitnesses who all provided details which seem to corroborate this story, but I guess the big issue is how much credibility they actually had. Charlene Wilson and Ronnie Godwin shared their stories while they were incarcerated in jail, and they were both known for having issues with drugs or alcohol. Wilson also revised her story initially claiming that she was just a witness, but then going so far as to admit that she was responsible for stabbing Dawn. However, it must be stated that Jean Duffy went to bat for Wilson and claimed that she always provided her with good information when she was an informant. And the eyewitness account from the enigmatic Jerry was shared secondhand by Mike Crook, who was also in jail at that time. While Crook claimed that Jerry was kept in jail for 90 days for non-payment of child support after he attempted to come forward and share this story with Sheriff Steed, the Saline County Sheriff's Office had pretty much destroyed all their records from this time period by the time anyone started looking into this, so we still can't even be 100% certain if Jerry actually exists. As for Tom Niehaus, I don't know much about his background, so I can't really gauge how much credibility he has, but of course, I do find it odd that he would be wandering through the woods in the middle of the night looking for a marijuana patch at age 10. The FBI did place Niehaus in protective custody after he shared this story, but then nothing ever came of it. So is that because the FBI no longer considered him to be credible, or were they just obstructing the investigation? And if Niehaus was in the woods with two other friends that night, were they ever questioned to confirm his story? The biggest issue I've always had with the account about the grocery store beating is that Dawn's mobile home was only about a mile away from the location where their bodies were found. If the boys really saw something which frightened them, and they wanted to call for help, why not go back to Dawn's residence rather than a payphone in a grocery store parking lot? And if Jerry was a real person, it does seem like quite a coincidence that two separate eyewitnesses would be hiding in the shadows watching that grocery store parking lot in the middle of the night. Now, I mentioned in part 1 that Jay Campbell and Kirk Lane filed a libel lawsuit against Patrick Matriciana for alleging that they were involved in this crime in the Obstruction of Justice documentary. And while the jury ruled in their favor, the verdict was later overturned on appeal. From reading the appeal, it sounds like neither of them had a solid alibi on the night of the murders and could not conclusively prove that they were not involved. But since over a decade had passed by that point, I wouldn't take the lack of alibi as a complete indicator of guilt. But it is interesting to see the divergent career paths these two men took after the lawsuit. If you do a search for Kirk Lane online, he seems to have a pretty decorated career in law enforcement, as he became chief of police for the Benton Police Department and was appointed Arkansas State Drug Director by Governor Asa Hutchinson in 2017. But on the opposite side of the coin, while Jay Campbell became police chief of the town of Lenoke, he would find himself implicated in a major scandal in 2006 when a total of 6 people, including Campbell and the town's mayor, were all arrested on a 78-count indictment, which included charges related to drugs, theft, and conspiracy. Campbell's wife was also indicted, as she would have sex with inmates at the city jail in exchange for them assisting her husband with his criminal activities, and Campbell himself ultimately received a 15-year prison sentence after pleading no contest to 4 felonies. So yes, it sounds like some of the people who have been implicated in the Boys in the Tracks murders, such as Campbell and Dan Harmon, are objectively terrible people who abuse their power in law enforcement, but does this mean the allegations against them in this case are true? Well, it's been reported that before their untimely deaths, both Keith Coney and Keith McCaskill have been displaying paranoid behavior and expressing that their lives were in danger because they knew too much about these murders. Since Coney was killed in a motorcycle crash, it is possible that his death was legitimately an accident, but it came about because he was being chased by someone and feared for his life. But the circumstances of McCaskill's murder are so bizarre that you could probably do an individual podcast episode about that case alone. So as you'll recall, McCaskill was killed only 2 days after Jim Steed lost re-election for Saline County Sheriff, and he supposedly made some cryptic remarks to imply that his life would be in danger because of this. A young neighbor of McCaskill's named Ronald Shane Smith was charged and convicted of his murder, but the conviction was overturned after the appeals court ruled that evidence which favored the defense had been unfairly excluded from his trial. Since neither Smith nor anyone else was ever charged with this crime, debate remains about whether Smith was the right guy all along. Well, I have to admit that when I first read Smith's account of what happened, it sounded so unbelievable that I had a hard time believing he could be innocent. After his bloody clothing was found in a river, Smith changed his story multiple times until he settled on a version where McCaskill was attacked by five masked men who took a photograph of Smith holding a knife over McCaskill's body in order to keep him quiet. Well, given that this massive conspiracy supposedly involved the murders of around half a dozen witnesses, it seems pretty odd to me that they would leave a living witness behind to McCaskill's death. If Smith was guilty, it's unclear what the motive for this murder would have been, though a silver tray and a bag containing seven pornographic videotapes were found in an outbuilding behind Smith's residence. While Smith claimed he had gone over to McCaskill's residence to purchase those items when the masked men arrived, if he was guilty, I suppose the theft of these items could have been the motive for the crime, though stabbing someone over 100 times to steal some porn tapes seems like major overkill. But in Smith's defense, since he had an IQ of only 81, some people questioned if he would have been capable of dreaming up such an elaborate story if it wasn't true. McCaskill was a considerably larger guy than Smith, so there was question about whether Smith would have been physically capable of staging such a brutal attack. And of course, there was a hair found in McCaskill's hand which did not match Smith, though it was theorized that it could have possibly been McCaskill's own hair. It's also been alleged that another man I previously mentioned, Joran Kettleson, who was killed in July of 1990, might have been behind McCaskill's murder, but since Kettleson's body was cremated, they could not check to see if he matched any of the physical evidence. Overall, I really don't know what to make of this crime, but if it was a setup, then this could have created a snowball effect, which led to the murders of additional people who had knowledge of McCaskill's death. But if Smith was the guilty party all along, then you have to wonder just how much relevance McCaskill really has to the murders of Kevin and Don. It's worth mentioning that McCaskill was known for being involved in the drug trade, so even if Smith's story is true, it's possible he was killed for reasons completely unrelated to the boys on the tracks. So the last law enforcement officer who was accused of being complicit in Don and Kevin's murders, and possibly being at the tracks on the night of the crime, is Danny Allen of the Bryant Police Department. Allen was interviewed during the Unsolved Mysteries segment to describe the incident where he was shot at by the mysterious man in military fatigues, but there is no mention of him at all in Mara Leverett's Boys on the Track book, and information about Allen and his alleged complicity is very scarce. The most I could gather is from the aforementioned Murder on the Tracks documentary, which explores a section from the original FBI documents about an individual who took a polygraph about this case and showed strong deception regarding their knowledge of who killed the boys and put their bodies on the track. While the individual's name is redacted in the document, the implication seems to be that it was Danny Allen. But otherwise, there's not much available info out there which supports the notion of him being involved in the murders. So now I think would be a good time to talk about the man in the military fatigues. The incident where he fired a shot at Allen's patrol car took place only about a week before Don and Kevin were killed, and a man in military fatigues was seen walking down a road located fairly close to the location of their deaths on the night of the crime. Now, I'm sure most people who watch the Unsolved Mysteries episode will tell you that the reenactments featuring the man in military fatigues are some of the creepiest sections of the segment, and the fact that he was never located or identified is pretty unsettling. But surprisingly, this man has never been brought up that much in the subsequent coverage of this case, and given all the conspiracy theories, you have to wonder if the military man has any real connection to the murders, or if he's been lost in the shuffle. But there is an interesting passage about him in the Boys on the Tracks book, and it appears that he might have a connection to Keith Coney. While he is never referred to by name, the book makes reference to a local tough who was suspected of running a large-scale theft ring which specialized in robbing Walmart stores, and he was apparently also looked at as a possible suspect in the deaths of Keith Coney, Greg Collins, and Daniel Booney Bearden. Well, the story goes that on the night the Unsolved Mysteries segment originally aired, this man was present at the Coney family residence and watched the episode with them. When the section about the man in the military fatigues came on, he supposedly pointed to the camouflage shirt he was wearing and said, quote, "Who do we all know that wears camouflage all the time? which kind of left the family unsettled. As far as I know, this person's identity has never been revealed publicly, so I have no idea if he has any real connection to this case. But none of the conspiracy theories involving Dan Harmon and corrupt law enforcement officials and drug drops account for a man in military fatigues, so it's possible he might be nothing more than a red herring. However, now that I presented the conspiracy theories, I want to take a few moments to look at this case from an alternate perspective and explore the possibility that all this stuff about drug trafficking is just smoke and mirrors, and Kevin and Don were killed for entirely different reasons. Interestingly enough, in 1992, years before she published Boys on the Tracks as a book, Mara Leverett had written an extensive article about this case for the Arkansas Times, which discussed another potential lead which was never mentioned in the book. It's possible it was not included because it was deemed to be irrelevant by the time the book was published, but I still think it's worth discussing. Before they went out hunting in the woods, Don and Kevin had spent most of the evening hanging out in a commuter parking lot with friends, but it appears that before they headed back to Don's residence, the two boys did part ways for a brief period of time. Sometime between 11 a.m. and midnight, a friend of Kevin's named Tim McCauley, who also happened to be his next-door neighbor, claimed that Kevin stopped by his residence to chat for a few minutes, but Don was not with him. And it appears there's been some confusion about Don's whereabouts during this time period before he met up with Kevin again and they headed to his mobile home. Two witnesses, including a friend of his named Charles Beck, claimed they saw Don at some stock car races near the county line between 11:30 and midnight, but for reasons unknown, Beck later changed his story and denied having seen Don or Kevin at all. Beck often went spotlighting with Don and admitted that he had initially planned to do so that night, but forgot about it and went to the stock car races instead. This might not seem very significant, except that a few weeks after the boys' deaths, a 14-year-old girl named Sharon Liggins would come forward and tell police that Beck's cousin, who was a friend of hers, had once told her that Beck had been in the woods with Don and Kevin that night, and two black guys had threatened him if he said anything about, quote-unquote, knocking the boys in the head and tying them on the tracks. And Beck also apparently mentioned that these two guys were in a pickup truck. Well, the detail about the boys being knocked in the head is particularly interesting because by this point, the boys' bodies had not yet been exhumed, and no one knew that Kevin had been hit in the face with the butt of a rifle. Beck's cousin was called upon to testify at the prosecutor's hearing, but she denied ever having shared that story. Beck himself testified at the prosecutor's hearing and the grand jury proceeding, but when the Arkansas State Police later asked Beck to take a polygraph to confirm his testimony, he refused. What's also interesting is that Curtis Henry has always claimed that when the boys arrived at his residence after midnight, he was already in bed and only spoke to Don inside the house while Kevin waited on the porch. Curtis said that he never actually saw Kevin or went outside at any point, so theoretically, if a third person had been with the boys at the time and was planning to go into the woods with them, Curtis would not have been in a position to confirm or deny it. Well, this whole story about Beck does have an interesting tie-in to another odd event which would take place during the early morning hours. It involves Shirley Raper, one of the original EMTs who was summoned to the scene, and shared a surprising story when she was called upon to testify at the prosecutor's hearing. Raper claimed that she had a hard time driving the ambulance to the location near the railroad tracks because it was such a remote area in the woods, but she wound up running into three black guys who were parked on a rarely used road in a pickup truck, and they would help guide Raper to the tracks. But what's odd is that when Raper asked the men what they were doing there in the woods at that hour, they claimed they were members of the volunteer fire department in the nearby town of Alexander and were surveying the scene in case they needed to offer assistance. But the problem is that Alexander did not even have a fire department. When Raper shared this story on the witness stand, she was asked why she had never told anybody about it before, and she said it was because no one ever asked her. Once again, this information was not public knowledge at the time Sharon Liggins originally shared her story about Charles Beck being threatened by a pair of black men in a pickup truck. The men Raper encountered were eventually identified as Tommy Lee Madison, Alan Smith, and Gary Pulliam. When questioned, Madison denied having any involvement in the boys' death, and the results of a polygraph he took seemed to indicate he was being truthful. Madison was later subpoenaed to testify during the grand jury proceedings, but he also wound up being arrested in an unrelated drug investigation and indicted on 8 counts of distributing cocaine, for which he received a 30-year prison sentence. So when you couple in the fact that Charles Beck had allegedly been threatened by 2 black guys in a pickup truck, and the EMT ran into a trio of black guys in a pickup truck who lied about why they were in close proximity to the murder scene, it does make you wonder, especially since one of them turned out to be a drug dealer. Of course, this whole series of events might not be significant at all, as perhaps Madison and his associates were in the woods that morning conducting illegal activity that had nothing to do with the case, which is why they lied about being members of the fire department. But I shared these details to address potential alternate scenarios that do not involve vast conspiracies involving corrupt law enforcement officials and drug trafficking. Given that there's a window of around 4 hours in which Kevin and Don's whereabouts are unaccounted for, the possibilities of what could have happened to them during that time period are limitless. Most of the theories surround the 2 boys stumbling upon something they weren't supposed to see, but could they have been planning to meet someone in the woods who subsequently killed them? Well, of course, the problem is that law enforcement instantly treated their deaths as an accident rather than a homicide, and lost, perhaps intentionally, key pieces of evidence which pointed towards foul play. If Don and Kevin were killed by a rather low-level drug dealer like Tommy Lee Madison, or murdered by someone they knew, would law enforcement really have gone to the trouble of attempting to cover the whole thing up? But on the other hand, this also makes you question why the likes of Dan Harmon and Richard Garrett would go to the trouble of exhuming the boys' bodies and launching a grand jury investigation if they were involved in what happened. If they had not done this, and the case had not received national exposure on Unsolved Mysteries, would people even remember it today? The theory of Harmon personally taking over the investigation to lead it in the wrong direction is not completely implausible. If Harmon wasn't involved in this crime, perhaps he intentionally wanted to steer the investigation away from the drug trafficking and other illegal activity that he was involved in. But if Harmon was complicit and present at the tracks when the murders took place, then he was still taking a huge risk by helping keep the story in the spotlight. The fact of the matter is that we have enough stories from different eyewitnesses to map out a theory which involves Kevin and Don stumbling upon one of Harmon's drug drops and being killed for it, but it depends entirely on how much you trust the credibility of these witnesses. Otherwise, there is just not a smoking gun to conclusively prove that these events unfolded this way. The whole case is a major jigsaw puzzle with so many different pieces, though I'm sure some people will tell you that the case is practically solved, and the only reason that the responsible parties have never been brought to justice is because of the major corruption from the people in power. If Bill Clinton had not been elected president in 1992, I've always been curious how people would look at this case today, as his very association with these events, no matter how tangential, have ensured that they have remained shrouded in conspiracy theories. I think the saddest issue is that the victims themselves, Don Henry and Kevin Ives, often get lost in the shuffle, and no matter what actually happened to them, the shoddy investigation and constant stonewalling of the victims' families has done them a great disservice. After all this time, I'm not sure if we'll ever get a resolution to this story and learn the complete truth about what happened, but if by chance you happen to have any information about the deaths of Don Henry and Kevin Ives, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Anyway, another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about the notorious Zip Gun Bomber, an unidentified individual who sent booby-trap packages to a number of different people that were rigged with a homemade Zip Gun device which fired off bullets when the packages were opened. And for our patrons in tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Becky D, Aisling M, and Jean F. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd also like to announce that next Monday, March the 1st, we'll see the release of the first in a series of episodes from a podcast called Riddle Me That, which I've plugged on this show before. These episodes will cover the tragic unsolved death of Jacob Landine, the infant brother of Eric Landine, who also hosts his own podcast called True Consequences. Here's a promo for this upcoming series of episodes about Jacob.
Hi, I'm Jules from Riddle Me That True Crime.
I'm Robin Warder from The Trail Went Cold, and Jules and I want to tell you a little bit about a case that means a great deal to us, the death of 9-month-old baby Jacob Landine on April the 10th, 1987, in Socorro, New Mexico.
The day prior to his death, on April 9th, baby Jacob was being watched by his mother Brenda's new boyfriend John, not his real name, in his mobile home on 1453 Fatima Drive. While John was babysitting Jacob, Jacob would incur what would be his second head injury in a period of weeks. The prior head injury was a subdural hematoma, or brain bleed, and it was serious enough that it needed to be lanced to take pressure off baby Jacob's brain while being monitored by doctors over the course of several days.
The circumstances surrounding how Jacob was injured and subsequently died are murky at best, with the suspect giving multiple versions of the events of the day, ranging from Jacob choking and accidentally hitting his head while trying to dislodge a cookie, to Jacob falling and John returning to see the injured infant.
The suspect also reportedly confessed to officers that he was indeed responsible, but there is no paper or audio record of this confession in the police file. The reasons given by the DA for not pursuing the case are confusing as well, with one of the reasons being that they were worried that John would file charges against the state.
It was the opinion of the doctors that baby Jacob was struck in the head and this was no accident. In the years to follow, John goes on to sexually abuse young Eric, as well as physically abusing his mother Brenda, and emotionally abusing and isolating them both, making the world very small.
During the autopsy, layers of abuse seem to be present. A healing rib fracture from around the time of the first head injury is also discovered. It's impossible to say exactly when the injury took place, but what is clear is that someone was abusing young Jacob, and that person was most likely John.
Eric Landine, Jacob's brother, has been fighting to get justice for him. However, he faces some obstacles, such as the statute of limitations of 6 years on second-degree murder that State Representative Bill Rehm has petitioned to have overturned.
Join Robin and I, as well as criminologist Dr. Ashley Wellman, an investigative expert, a legal expert, a forensic psychiatrist, as well as Jacob's brother Eric, as we explore all angles of this case and try to bring awareness, understanding, and hopefully, ultimately, justice for Jacob.
The series starts on March the 1st. Tune in on your favorite podcast app. I'd also like to mention that later this year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at two separate CrimeCon events. The regular CrimeCon, which takes place at the Fairmont Hotel in Austin, Texas, from June 4th until the 6th, and the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London the following weekend, on June 12th and the 13th. If you would like to purchase tickets to either event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount, and it applies to both the Austin and London events. So to receive 10% off, either visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I hold what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes of every episode, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, which both have a number of interesting threads about this case, and there is a ton of reading material out there about it. Of course, I also need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music you hear on every episode. They've both been with me on this podcast for all 5 of these years and provided tremendous support, and I never would have gotten The Trail Went Cold off the ground without them. Hopefully, when this pandemic comes to an end, you might be able to meet all 3 of us at a podcasting event sometime down the road. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, it's surreal to think that The Trail Went Cold has reached its 5-year anniversary milestone and produced over 200 episodes, which have covered nearly 300 cases, as it's not easy for all independent podcasts to make it that far. I know that when we dropped our 4-year anniversary show last February, we never would have anticipated that we were only weeks away from the COVID-19 pandemic, which would completely change our lives and create one of the most difficult years ever. We hope the world can return to normalcy someday, but whatever happens, we're still grateful for the amazing support from our listeners who have stuck with us over the past year, and I'm glad that podcasting is the one medium where we can continue producing content for you even when the world is in a difficult place. So we hope you all stay safe and healthy, and thank you all so much for making this such an amazing ride. Have yourself a great week, and join us next Wednesday for our first brand new episode of Year 6 of The Trail Went Cold.